This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. U.S. media outlets report Saudi Arabia is preparing to acknowledge the death of missing Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who vanished after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul October 2nd. It's being described as a botched abduction and interrogation. President Donald Trump said he spoke with Saudi King Salman about the matter, who denied knowledge of it. Mr. Trump suggested rogue killers may have been involved and dispatched Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to the region.
Well, I'm really sending him just to find out really firsthand what happened, what they know, what's going on. He may go to Turkey, he may not. He may meet with all of them together, but we want to find out what happened.
Mr. Trump has threatened to engage in severe punishment if Khashoggi is murdered. Khashoggi, a U.S. resident, after leaving his country a year ago, fearing retribution, has been highly critical of Saudi policy. Riyadh has strongly denied killing the journalist. Turkish police were allowed access to the Istanbul consulate late Monday, part of a joint Turkish-Saudi team to search the building as part of Ankara's investigation, an important step, according to European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini.
We said, I think we are completely on the same page with our American friends on this. We expect transparency and we wait for having more clarity on what happened on that case that is particularly the dramatic one.
A Turkish publication last week reported a 15-member Saudi intelligence team entered the consulate at the same time as Khashoggi. The World Health Organization says it will decide if the latest Ebola outbreak in Democratic Republic of Congo warrants a public health emergency. The latest outbreak, declared August 1st, has taken at least 130 lives, with 24 fatalities among 33 confirmed cases in the past week. Dozens have received new experimental treatments, with just over half recovered. This is VOA News. President Trump and his wife Melania Monday got a first-hand look at the devastation caused by last week's Hurricane Michael along Florida's Gulf Coast with a stop they made in the community of Lynn Haven.
Yeah, look behind you. I mean, these massive trees are just ripped out of the earth. We've seen mostly water, and water can be very damaging and horrible and scary, you know, when you see water rising 14, 15 feet, but nobody's seen anything like this. This is really incredible.
The president and first lady passed out bottles of drinking water at an aid station. Nearly 20 deaths have been blamed on the storm, which roared ashore last Wednesday as a severe Category 4 hurricane. Scores are still missing. Hundreds of thousands are without power. In southern France, at least 11 have died in flash flooding, with up to 7 months' worth of rainfall in just a matter of hours. A downpour authorities said they've not seen since the late 19th century.
Il faut aujourd'hui d'abord s'attacher à traiter l'urgence.
Prime Minister Edouard Philippe, who toured the disaster zone, said search and rescue efforts continue, along with providing fresh drinking water and reestablishing power. Germany Monday said it deported a Moroccan associate of the September 11, 2001 hijackers after he served most of a 15-year jail term for organizing attacks in the U.S. Manour El Montazegdeg was one of only two men convicted so far of involvement in the so-called 9/11 plot. Microsoft Corporation co-founder Paul Allen died Monday at age 65 from complications of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a type of cancer. Bill Hilf is CEO of the investment firm Vulcan, a company that Allen also founded.
I think I'll remember most about how big he thought. He redefined what big thinking was for me. I've never met anyone in my life who wanted to do so much good in the world in such a big way.
Allen was instrumental in getting Bill Gates to create the world's largest computer software company in the 1970s. A commentary that appeared in North Korea state-run KCNA news agency Tuesday criticized the U.S. for an evil attempt to maintain sanctions, accusing President Trump of blocking progress in inter-Korean relations. It called on the administration in Washington to take corresponding steps in response to what it called Pyongyang's conciliatory actions. In Nepal, the bodies of 5 South Korean climbers and 4 Nepali guides were recovered as they attempted to reach the summit of the 7,200-meter-tall Mount Gerja. The West African country Gambia Monday launched a Truth, Reconciliation, Reparations Commission on the abuses committed during the 22-year rule of former leader Yahya Jammeh, accused of extrajudicial killings and torture. President Adama Barrow declared the country's dark days over, vowing to deliver justice to the victims. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bucky in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The writer of an investigative report and a documentary that exposed what some are calling a rape empire in Liberia speaks on reaction to his work.
Certainly, I think in various ways, harm could have been mitigated or even prevented had there been greater oversight, primarily within the organization, but also over the organization from structures within Liberia.
That's journalist Finlay Young of ProRepublica Time magazine. Fresh fighting in South Sudan's Ye River County has displaced hundreds of civilians. A Ugandan opposition party plans to rally today in Kasese, despite a government plan to stop it. A released female Rwandan political prisoner speaks out about life in Rwandan jails.
It's hard to put into words the experience of being in prison. All I can say is you meet the strongest people over there, people who still have hope despite the difficulties.
That's former Rwandan presidential candidate Diane Rigara. Leaders from northeastern Kenya demand protection from al-Shabaab militia, and the world's largest rice seed bank receives a perpetuity grant. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The journalist who wrote the investigative article and a documentary exposing what some are calling an empire of rape within the More Than Me Academy in Liberia says he thinks harm could have been mitigated or even prevented had there been oversight over the organization from structures within Liberia. This comes as the Liberian government Monday expressed concern about the alleged rape and violation of the rights of disadvantaged girls enrolled at the More Than Me Academy. Young says he's glad his article got a strong response from many people because it touched on important issues that reveal some challenges that affect a whole lot of people.
The reaction, I think it's fair to say, has been quite strong from a lot of different angles. And that includes the government of Liberia, includes the organization itself, and also the Liberian public and wider sort of international development community as well. But I think that this article touched on some really important issues and revealed some challenges that affect an awful lot of different people, not least in Liberia. So in that respect, I'm not that surprised that it's had a strong response, but I'm glad that it's got people engaging with the complex issues around international intervention and in particular with this charity in Liberia.
So Finn, what did you find in your investigation that went wrong in Liberia with this More Than Me Academy? After all, the alleged rape and violation of the rights of these disadvantaged girls took place during the administration of a Liberian government headed by a woman. What did you find went wrong?
Quite a lot of things went wrong, James. But I think that to start off with, it's important to recognize the context in which this organization was starting up. In Liberia in 2010, when the organization started distributing scholarships, it was really a time where there wasn't great regulation of not only international groups, but really anybody. You know, the war really wasn't that long past, and the Liberian government was still finding its feet. So as a starting point, there was a huge gap in services and a lot of need for help. That's a gap that Katie Myler and More Than Me stepped in to really try and fill in West Point. In terms of failures, well, I think that there are many. And, of course, it starts from the beginning with the man who did these acts. At the same time, there were failures of oversight, there were failures of selection, there were failures of transparency, and there were failures of care to really, really vulnerable girls who ended up being exploited horribly while in the care of this organization.
I'm sure you are aware that the Liberian government on Monday came out with a series of recommendations, among which is the reopening of the case because of your reporting. What's your reaction first to that particular part of their recommendation to reopen the case?
Well, it's hard to say, really, what that means in the Liberian legal context. I'm certainly glad to see that the Liberian government is looking deeper into what happened in the case and within the charity. Obviously, the defendant is deceased. So in that respect, I'm not sure what form of reopening will take place. But certainly to see the Liberian government really taking this seriously and really looking into exactly what happened, as we tried to do with our reporting, I think is a really good sign. And I'll be interested to see what is the follow-through once all of the publicity dies down, as it invariably does.
The other proposal that the government made is that the Ministry of Education will strengthen the monitoring and evaluation and ensure that regulation and compliance surrounding all schools are intensified. Based on what happened, perhaps there was less scrutiny on the registration of these kind of schools.
I think that's definitely accurate. And I think that that lack of scrutiny really has been a core problem during this period for Liberia and many other countries as well. I think that there is a sense that where the need was so great for education, that if someone was willing to come and offer it and someone was able to access large amounts of funds, then there wasn't really that much regulation of them. And the bureaucratic systems, perhaps at the time, were also not that strong in Liberia. So certainly, I think in various ways, harm could have been mitigated or even prevented had there been greater oversight, primarily within the organization, but also over the organization from structures within Liberia.
Finlay Young is a freelance journalist who wrote the article and the documentary exposing what some have called an empire of rape within the More Than Me Academy in Liberia. He was speaking with me from New York City. Hundreds of civilians are fleeing their homes in Ye River County's Minyori Payam following deadly clashes between rival armed opposition groups for four straight days. The Ye River County Commissioner says an unknown number of civilians have been killed in the fighting. A SPLA-IO spokesperson confirms the fighting continues, but accuses National Salvation Front rebels of attacking SPLA-IO positions. Daniel Friday Mountain reports for VOA from Ye.
Hundreds of exhausted-looking civilians, mostly women and children, are camping under a large mango tree at the Episcopal Church compound in Ye, while aid workers attend to the IDPs trying to assess their needs. Displaced villager Monica Dudu says she saw many bodies lying on the ground as she fled the area yesterday. Speaking in her native Kakwa language while fighting back tears, Dudu says when they heard gunshots, she and her husband ran in separate directions. She says she does not know her husband's whereabouts.
I ran without anything. I didn't know where my husband ran off to. The fighters have been moving from one house to another in our hideouts. The fighting continues and I saw dead bodies on the ground, but I could not count how many they were because of the fighting.
Dudu is calling on humanitarian organizations to rescue the displaced villagers with food and non-food items. Timon Lubari, a Minyori Payam local community leader, says rebel fighters burned down their entire village. Speaking in Kakwa, Lubari says rather than fighting each other, some of the rebel fighters turned their anger on civilians, including children and women.
We ran with nothing. Once the armed men get you, whether you're a child, a woman or elderly, you will be killed. We don't know how many people had been killed at the moment.
Lobari says the fighting has spread to Logo and Pisak villages. Ye River County Commissioner Justin Lokonga confirmed the fighting is ongoing in the area, but says he does not know why the two sides are fighting each other.
Those clashes in the area of Minyori Payam, a group of William Thomas and then versus IO headed by Gad. They clash among themselves and they displace very many people. About four people wounded too seriously. They are in the hospital now. A number of deaths, which I cannot account because we are not there as a government. We as a government, we are for peace and then we have started implementing the peace.
Lokonga condemns the fighting and is urging the rebel groups to respect the peace deal. SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Lampaul Gabriel also confirmed fighting continues, but accused National Salvation Front forces led by General Thomas Cirillo of attacking SPLA-IO positions.
We know that Thomas Cirillo does not want the peace and he has not signed the peace. So it's a clear sign that Thomas Cirillo means his business and that's why he's fighting us.
South Sudan in focus could not reach National Salvation Front spokesman Yen Meteo for comments as his phone numbers were unreachable. Chapter 2 of the Sand Security Deal prohibits all parties to the agreement from participating in hostile actions or displacing civilians. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin, reporting from Ye Town.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 16th. Daybreak Africa Time, 15 minutes past the hour. The leader of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change, FDC Party, says his group will meet with supporters as planned in Kasese Town today, Tuesday. Patrick Oboy Amurat remarks come after police prevented him and party officials from traveling in separate vehicles from the two-day planning meetings in Kasese District. The police said the party failed to get clearance from the Inspector General. Amura tells VOA's Peter Clotty the police action violates the constitutional protection of freedom of assembly.
What has happened is that I was forcefully evicted by the police, removed from Kasese and driven out of the district near 100 kilometers away from the district under very circumstances.
But Patrick, we had reports that a police specifically told you to meet all requirements and that you failed to do so, leading to their action to prevent you and your group from going to Kasese and other meetings you've scheduled.
Well, I don't understand what the requirements of the police under the law are. Personally, I know that it is out of courtesy that we would always, you know, ask for police clearance. Under the law, however, Section 4 of the Public Order Management Act, we as political parties are not under any obligation to seek clearance from the police for public meetings. And so, to me, really, the police has chosen to offend the law. They have chosen to ignore the provisions of the law and instead turned against the public as far as this interpretation of this law is concerned.
Patrick, the police, I understand, wanted to know the nature of guests at the planned event, the time, the expected crowd size, and the purpose of the rallies, among others, before they could clear you and your group from going ahead with the planned event. Why didn't you simply meet these requirements in order to ensure that your planned events go on unhindered?
Whatever was required by the law was adhered to. The police do not have to know who, by name or size, is coming to our event. The choice of who comes to our event is up to us. So long as these are not criminals and are on the right side of the law, as far as I know, all of us are Ugandans who have got a right to go to every little corner of this country, carrying out our activities normally. And so for us, we think that this is a direct attack on the opposition in this country. It is meant to curtail our activities and stop us posing a challenge against the junta.
NRM supporters are saying that your refusal to abide by what the police were asking you to do is an indication of your intransigence and a challenge to the authority of the police just to score cheap political points.
We don't expect anything different from what they have said. We never went to look for any publicity. We did not set up the roadblocks that stopped us entering Kasese. All that we went to do in this western district of Uganda is to mobilize our people. And, you know, that is just a normal activity of any political party.
Patrick Oboy Amurat is the leader of the Uganda Main Opposition Forum for Democratic Change. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Port Portal in Uganda's western region. Former Rwandan presidential candidate Diane Rwigara says she will continue her political activism because she wants her People's Salvation Movement to be the voice of the voiceless in Rwanda. Rwigara and her mother were released on bail earlier this month after spending over a year in jail on charges that included incitement against President Paul Kagame's government. She tells me life in Rwandan prisons, especially with her mother, was not easy.
Well, it's hard to put into words the experience of being in prison. All I can say is you meet those strongest people over there, people who still have hope despite the difficulties.
I wanted to ask you, because you were jailed along with your mother, how did it feel to be put in jail with your mother?
Unfortunately, in Rwanda, people are guilty by association. If I have an opinion, a different opinion from the government, then my family, my loved ones, my entourage get punished for it. And that's why we need change in Rwanda. things cannot continue this way, where not only I get punished because I speak up, but also my family and my loved ones. People should not be punished for other people's opinions.
So tell me, Diane, why do you think President Paul Kagame released you?
I think that's a question he should answer. That's a question you should ask him.
Is it because you think he was being generous or because of his desire to open up the political space in Rwanda or because of the international pressure that was brought bear on him because of your imprisonment?
I don't know exactly the reason. Time will tell. If the reason was because he wanted to open political space, then only time will tell. For now, I cannot answer that question with accuracy. Maybe it's also, that pressure. Maybe it's because he wants to open the political space. I don't know. We'll see what happens in the future.
So let's talk about the charges against you for which you were arrested and jailed. What do you make of the charges?
The charges were made up. The only reason I was arrested was because I tried to run for president. In Rwanda, whoever challenges the government ends up being punished. And unfortunately, I was not the only one being punished. My mother was also imprisoned. Our family businesses were taken over by the government. My supporters were harassed. Some have disappeared. That's how politics work in Rwanda.
The government said that you falsified the names of your supporters in order for you to qualify to run for president.
That's false. They're just trying to explain why they arrested me. They could not explain why they would not allow me to run because I had so many supporters. So they came up with that false charge.
Before you were arrested, Diane, and jailed, you launched this an activist movement called People's Salvation Movement, Itabaza, to challenge President Kagame. Will you continue your political activism?
Oh, definitely. I want that movement to be the platform, to be the place, to be the channel through which we Rwandans can express ourselves. I want it to be the voice for the voiceless.
That's former Rwandan presidential candidate Diane Rwigara speaking with me by Skype from Kigali. Political leaders from northeastern Kenya say they want protection from Al-Shabaab militia, especially as Kenya's national examinations approach. This followed frequent attacks by the militant group on institutions of learning. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i has assured the leaders the government will provide the security.
During a meeting held on Monday in Nairobi, the Northeastern leaders called on the security personnel to ensure safety of the region. Mandera Governor Ali Roba said the region does not attract investors due to frequent attacks by the Al-Shabaab militants. On the other hand, National Assembly Majority Leader Aden Duale, who is also a member of Parliament for Garissa Township, maintains that there must be collaboration for any war against Al-Shabaab to succeed.
Over and above that, the people of Northern Kenya mourn loss of lives as well as the economic, socio-economic alienation of the region as a result of targeted attacks of by Al-Shabaab that has alienated the region socio-economically. Our education sector has gotten affected. The healthcare sector has gotten affected. Construction industry has come to a halt. We cannot attract professionals into our region. External investment has not come.
On the situation in the region, we, the representatives of the people, have agreed in government that all of us together must read from one script in the war against Al-Shabaab.
Education Cabinet Secretary Amina Mohammed assured the leaders that education officers will visit the areas before the exam kicks off on 30th of this month. She also said the department has put in place measures to curb insecurity in the area during the exam period.
We are prepared to carry out the exams in that part of the country. It's all systems go, and requested for their support in ensuring that the process moves smoothly. And so I think from next week we'll be moving to that region to just make sure that all the exam systems and centers are ready for action.
Northeastern Kenya is notorious for insecurity due to almost monthly attacks by the militia group. However, Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i said security will be enforced in areas such as Narok County, in the Rift Valley region, and Marsabit County in eastern Kenya that are currently experiencing tribal clashes.
I want to assure all Kenyans who work in the northeastern part of our country, wherever they come from in Kenya, all public servants, whether they are teachers, health professionals, administrators, our police officers, all public servants who work in the northeastern part of our country, that they are safe. One isolated incident should not worry or scare. We work together. We are collaborating, collecting intelligence, planning ahead.
The meeting was triggered by last week's attack at the Arabia High School in Mandera County, where two teachers were killed and others injured after Al-Shabaab militants threw an explosive device on the teachers' quarters. Civil servants who are non-locals in the area, especially teachers, have been demanding transfers, a move that the government has always opposed and even threatened to fire teachers. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
For the first time, the world's largest rice seed bank has received a perpetuity grant that will secure their funding in years to come. Their goal is to fund other crop seed banks that are necessary in the years to come. The head of the Crop Trust, Marie Hagar, tells Ricky Stryak.
So the grant that will go on forever allows the Gene Bank to safeguard the 136,000 varieties that they have. It's awfully important that crop collections or gene banks, call them whatever you want, that they are managed constantly because if electricity goes off, you know, if management can't deal with the material on a constant basis, this material will die. So that's why it is so important that these collections are not hostage to budgets going up and down. So this will allow for the seeds to be safe in a forever perspective.
I know what it means from a crop perspective, but does it have any impact on availability of food?
In the long run, it does, because each variety of, in this case, rice, have unique traits. So when we want to breed plants that can adapt to other conditions, we go back to this diversity and see which variety is it that is able to, for example, stand higher temperature, tolerate higher salinity in the soil, that can fight a new pest or a new disease, which is it that maybe has higher nutritional value or even have better taste. So what this allows is for scientists to have access to all this diversity forever and to use it for whatever circumstances occurs.
And I know this is a worldwide initiative, but can you tell me a little bit specifically about how that might affect rice farmers in sub-Saharan Africa?
So the challenge for rice production in Africa, as it is in many parts of the world, is climate change. And when we want to breed varieties that can adapt to new circumstances, we have to go back to this diversity. And this is, of course, essential for farmers who feed the world. So it's essential for those who produce the food, as well as it is essential for all of us who eat this food every day.
That was Marie Hagar, head of the Crop Trust. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Norway. And that is it for this Tuesday, October 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very, very productive week.
Hello, I'm Lino Mdu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we'll have a special discussion on women's well-being around the world. Our guest is Christina Kessler, author of the book Tales of a Nikut Swamir. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.